And in the studio, I got Stephanie Philp for the first time this year. Morning, Stephanie.
Good morning. Happy New Year, everybody.
Yes, indeed. Let's just try and get that in the right place.
Okay.
Kind of there like that. Mm-hmm. So, how have you been? It's been a while since we spoke.
I've been fine.
You've been fine. That's good.
Yeah.
Well, this is weird. Honestly, it's weird because we were just talking and here I am saying it's been a while since we spoke. But
yeah, at least 4 seconds.
Yeah, at least 4 seconds.
No, but I haven't been on radio since last year.
Yeah,
Probably about November or maybe early December.
I had at least 5 weeks off the show.
Right. So
and then we've been trying to make our schedules align.
Yeah, exactly.
It's since then. So yeah, well done.
Yeah,
we're here. Well done, us. So Stephanie, we do a segment with Stephanie called Inside Your Mind. Stephanie does neuro-linguistic programming as well as other associated things.
Yeah.
This is a really concise description of what you do. You help people with stuff though.
Yeah, I coach people and I train people and I write. And yeah, you're right, you know, like it is, I do teach and coach people using neuro-linguistic programming, but there's a lot of other things over the years that I've done training in that I'm always learning something new. And so if you learn something and you learn it well and then you teach it to other people, it becomes part of who you are and what you do. So sometimes
right.
It's hard to determine when, you know, NLP or doing NLP ends and other stuff starts. And usually it all aligns anyway because NLP is all about who we are and what we do and how we do it.
Mm-hmm.
So
NLP came up. I was listening to a podcast the other day. A guy who he's an archer. He's got a son who's 15 who's beating everyone in archery at the moment, adults included.
All right.
And this is a guy who spent years trying to figure out, and NLP was part of his journey of trying to figure out how to control the moment when you're shooting either guns or archery.
Right, right.
And it sounds like what everyone's doing is, because there's, like when you shoot a gun, after the first time it happens, your body naturally thinks, okay, there's going to be an explosion in it, and the muscles all tense up waiting for the explosion.
Oh, right.
Which puts you off your shot.
Right, right.
So all the really good people have worked out where to shoot. Like they shoot away from the target, taking into account where their body's going to move.
Yeah.
And he's worked out a way of stopping that from happening.
Right.
And so you just aim accurately.
Right.
And shoot. And NLP was just part of the journey of trying to figure out how to do that. He's been like a decade trying to work it out.
That's interesting. There was I think it was John Grinder, one of the co-developers of NLP that worked with the... Well, it might have been both Bandler and Grinder, the two developers, worked with the US military, you know, like years and years ago, because they had some really good sharpshooters in the military.
Yeah.
And they also had some people that weren't very good. So they said, you know, we want you to make all the sharpshooters like really, really good rather than just some of them mediocre.
Yep.
And so it was like something like a 6-month program. And they ended up reducing it to 6 weeks. And for the first 3 weeks, they didn't even get a gun. You know,
because the problem wasn't how they handled the gun.
Right, it was about what they were doing in the head.
Yeah.
And one of the things I found, which I found particularly interesting, is that the people that weren't as good, what they do is they get the gun and let's say it had 50 rounds in it. So they'd look at the target and go and fire it, and then they go, okay, I've got 49 left. And then they'd fire it again and go, okay, I've got 48 left. And they count down. And the closer they got to nil, the worse they got.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So there was kind of like this extra pressure on, you know, I've only got 49 left, 48 left, 47 left, and it went like that. And the people that were really good, it was like they just took a shot.
Yeah.
And each shot was individual. And so that kind of sounds a bit like what this guy was doing. It's about being in the present moment, because often we're thinking about what we've got to do next or what we should have done before.
Yeah.
And which means we're not present to being here right now.
Well, he talked about this competition where you're 20 feet away and you have to hit a penny 60 times in a row, and hardly anyone can do it.
Wow.
And he said the time that people most likely to screw up is on that last one.
Right.
Because they're like, this is it.
Yeah,
you know,
this is the last one.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's
it's
right.
A big moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that's it again. It's like that putting the extra pressure on that's in the future again.
Yeah.
So the people that were the best sharpshooters were just in the now. It's like there's one, there's another one, another one, another one. Not 50, 49, 48 and counting down or up.
Yeah, you know. And there's some sports where you don't have time to mess your own head up.
Yeah. Well, like that would be probably one.
Yeah, but yeah, obviously archery, cricket's another one where batsmen in particular they've tried to get in that zen state basically, just right. Focus on the next ball.
Yeah.
And leave everything else out of the picture.
Well, it's quite interesting because it doesn't really matter what it is. I mean, I'm thinking particularly of presenting something. So, you know, people who have to go on stage, or they don't even have to go on stage. It could be just they've got a presentation to do at work. And so, you know, I've done a lot of work with people who have presentation anxiety. And there's a whole lot of things that kind of that they do in common that cause them to have the anxiety. And of course, when they're in an anxious state, that anxious state shows. I mean, we can see somebody that's anxious, right?
Yeah.
And so what happens then is the audience get anxious as well, because they've come to listen to this person talk about something, and he's this person, not necessarily on a stage, but in front of them, who's anxious, and they can see that they're anxious, and so they get worried that the presentation's going to be crap, and that, you know, the guy or the woman is not going to be very good, and so they start to get nervous as well, because they want you to succeed, because they feel terrible if you don't.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
And a lot of people that are presenting don't realise this. So there's a whole lot of things that they do in the mind that cause them to be anxious. So do you want me to give you some examples?
Go on.
Okay.
Yep.
So one thing is they imagine themselves being useless. So they might imagine themselves having a whole lot of cards, for example, with the presentation on cards, and then dropping the cards and they're all out of order and they can't get them back in order, and they imagine themselves like picking them all up off the floor,
right,
and being embarrassed. So, and basically what they're doing is programming their unconscious to do just that.
They're
right?
Visualising
all the wrong things.
Yeah.
The other thing that they do is when they're preparing, they don't prepare with an imaginary audience. They're just going through their notes or their PowerPoint presentation or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And then it's completely different when they've got an audience in front, because they might imagine the audience as being, typically, higher up than they are. So they feel small in comparison.
Yeah.
Yeah. They imagine people with angry faces, 20% bigger than what they normally are. And sometimes they even imagine that they're throwing things at them, like rotten fruit and stuff.
This is, again, visualising all the wrong stuff.
So you can imagine that if they're doing all this when they're kind of rehearsing, that when they get to actually do the thing, their unconscious mind is going, oh, okay, this is it. This is where we get the fruit thrown at us. This is where we do this.
We've got to be on guard. We've got to look out.
And the other thing that you know, people will go, oh, well, it's natural to be a bit nervous. And I go, no, it's not. You're just talking to people. You don't get nervous when you talk to people normally. You know, like I'm talking to you. I'm not nervous. Hopefully you're not nervous about me. So all you're doing is you're multiplying that person by however many is in the audience. But they, because there's so much well, it's bullshit, really, about, you know, it's natural to get a bit nervous. I go, no, it's not, because why would you get nervous just talking to people? It's like saying, okay, we've got to elect a leader, you know, so there's 50 people in the room. Let's pick the most nervous one to be our leader. That's never going to happen. They're going to pick the person that looks most confident and knows what they're talking about, aren't they? They're not going to pick the most nervous person that can't string a sentence together. So it's not natural to be nervous when you talk to people at all.
It might be,
but it's been promulgated by other people who have got over their nervousness, and they say, oh, it's, you know, if you've got a few nerves, it means, you know, you're going to be better. Well, it doesn't. It's rubbish. I can tell you, it's crap.
I think there are some. I heard of some people, like some sportsmen, who are really at the top and super confident, and sometimes a little bit of nerves gets them some focus. But that's a very different. That's a different kettle of fish to the average person who suddenly has to talk in front of a crowd.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing is, it's the difference between adrenaline. You know, like,
okay,
like I can be like really excited to be delivering. Well, it's a different feeling.
That's another way of getting adrenaline. You don't have to make yourself nervous.
Yeah, exactly. You don't have to make yourself nervous, anxious and stressed out. You can just go, oh, this is really exciting. I can't wait to talk to these people and, you know, tell them the information that I've got because I know it's useful. Because that's the other thing. Then they imagine people either heckling them or that the information that they're going to give is not worth having or something like that. And so when they then get in front of the people, all of these things that they've rehearsed in their mind, the mind goes, the unconscious mind goes, oh, yeah, okay, here we go, this is what we do.
Yeah. So it's not natural, but it is quite common. And are you saying we're learning this from other people's expectations?
Well, I think we are, because the number of people that I've seen, they say, oh, you know, I've been told that it's natural to get a bit nervous. Well, you know, why? It doesn't even make any sense, you know, because as I say, you wouldn't be nervous. It's like saying you need to be nervous to drive a car. Well, you know, the person that's nervous driving a car is the worst driver. So the person that's speaking that's nervous is going to be the worst speaker. You know, when you think about it logically, but usually they've been taught by people who have got nervous when they spoke and got over it. So it's promulgated by them saying, right, you know, it's natural to get a bit nervous.
So what's the story you tell people that they need to hear rather than that you're going to be nervous?
Well, it's basically the opposite of what I've just said. So first of all, I find out how they're doing the anxiety.
Yeah.
And as I say, it's usually that they're imagining themselves, you know, like tripping up the stage, dropping all the cards, and then they're imagining the audience. Then they're not aware of this. This is the thing. This is something that's going on in their mind that they're not really aware of. How they're thinking about it. So I have to figure out what they're doing, and then I say, okay, so you know, when you think about the people in the audience, whereabouts are they in your mind's eye? And they usually, you know, point up.
Right.
It's an angle. And I go, okay, so they're up there. And how far away are they? And sometimes they're only like 3 feet away. So they've got these people that are up high and they're 20% bigger than they would be in real life. And they're smaller. They make themselves smaller.
So you've got these questions that you ask people and they must be kind of surprised, you know.
Yeah, they do. And then they go, what happens if you move the people down a bit? And they'll go, you know, like that feels better, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And what happens if you move them away? And sometimes they might have them, you know, with red angry faces. Okay, what happens if you put the smile on the people's face?
Yeah.
And all of this, you can see them just relaxing more and more because now they've changed how they perceive the audience. Because the audience are just people. I mean, they must want to know what the person's got to say or they wouldn't be coming along, you know.
I still think most people are going to get nervous in some situations.
Yeah, well, they are because they're making themselves nervous.
Yeah, but most people won't. I think most people don't see it that way. They just say, no, it's the crowd that's making me nervous.
Yeah, but then that's them saying, you know, that everybody else is responsible for my emotions.
We have a tendency to do, don't we?
Do we?
I think so.
Well, again, it's like we're taking responsibility for our own lives.
Yeah.
You know, because otherwise we're just puppets on strings. You know, if we allow other people to control our emotions, then they can just move another string and we'll behave a different way.
But how often do we people say, oh, you're making me upset or that's making me upset, you know, that sort of thing, something external to ourselves?
Well, then, you know, again, it's like that person needs to take responsibility for their own emotions. Because the thing is, if you have three people in a room, well, say you have four people, and one person says something, and one person goes, oh, I'm offended by that. And it's like, okay, tough, you're offended, get over it, you know. The other people just laugh.
Yeah.
You know, so who's responsible for how you feel then, you know? You've got to take responsibility for your own emotions. And I think, you know, at the moment, there's, you know, people can get offended about everything, you know. And it's like, okay, get over it. You're not going to die from being offended. You know.
Are you sure, Stephanie?
I was watching a comedian a few weeks ago and he was, I think it was quite an old one. He goes, okay, well, you're offended. You're not going to die from it, you know. It's just get over it. It's just, so what? So you're offended. Okay, if it's on television, turn it off, you know. Take responsibility for it because somebody else won't be.
Mm, mm. All right, so ages ago we had an idea of what we were going to talk about for the this interview. Are we going to go to that, or are we going to stick with?
Well, it's up to you.
Now let's make a detour okay. Or back on course. You wanted to talk about beliefs, although we kind of are a little bit, aren't we?
We are a bit, yeah, because yeah. You know, a lot of people have got a belief that, again, if you're going to talk to people in a group, then it's okay to be nervous.
Or even compulsory.
Yeah, that, exactly. Unavoidable. It's compulsory because it's, you know, they say that, what is it, public speaking is the second biggest fear next to death, for goodness sake. There's a whole lot of stuff
is
on
that,
that.
Is that just in Western culture? Are there other, I'm really curious to know if it's in universally across all cultures through all times.
I think it's just, I don't know. I mean, I haven't done any research on that and where you go to actually do that because, I don't know, but I think it's more something that's, as I said, promulgated by people who have been nervous speakers and got over it. Or sometimes they haven't got over it. They're still doing it and they're still teaching other people, how to give speeches and be nervous.
Yeah.
I mean, I've got a book on the website called Presentations That Rock, and I wrote that book so that people could put a presentation together in a way that felt comfortable for them. So it teaches you how to put a presentation together like a PowerPoint or Keynote if you're on Mac, and how to do the slides. Because the other thing that people do when they're speaking is they put like so much information on a slide. Yes. It's like, you know, I'll just copy this page and put this up as a slide, and you can see people slither down in the seats like, oh, get beam me up, Scotty, there's no life here, you know.
It's really hard when you're young to I think we get going through school and university, volume equals success. Yeah. And your essay writing and your assignments, like that's one way to just write lots and you'll get better grades, and it kind of does work. But yeah, back out in the real world where there's just average people who don't have a marking schedule.
Yeah.
They're just like, this is boring.
Exactly. And so the other thing with the presentations at Rock, it's about like how many words you put on the screen at once. So preferably, you know, I think I've got 15 words. So you can take in 15 words, but better still, you know, pictures. Because you can put a picture and, you know, people put the whole speech on the PowerPoint. It's like, well, why don't you just fire up the PowerPoint and you could go and have a coffee somewhere and make your life useful.
Let everybody read it.
Let everybody read it and then come back when they're finished, you know.
All right, so your advice for presentations is not just about nerves but about preparation.
There's two things. So in the presentations at Rock, there's like how to put a presentation together so that you're not boring everybody and so that they're engaged. And then the other part is what's the psychological aspects that you need to cope with so that when you're up there and you're doing your presentation, you feel relaxed and confident or however you want to feel other than nervous, anxious and stressed out. Yeah, so there's two parts to it. And it's come about by working with a lot of people that have presentation anxiety or had presentation anxiety and how do they get over it. And the thing is, once they realise how they're doing it, they can stop, you know, like instantly, because they're not realising what they're doing in the head.
Yeah. And it's in the moment, it's really hard to do because that's when you're probably in a panic state. What do you think?
Exactly.
They think it's going to be terrible, it's going to be terrible.
They don't think about it, what it's like to have an audience in front. So they've run through all the presentation things, they've got all that. But they don't think about what it's going to be like when there's an audience in front. And then when there is an audience in front, it's like all these things come back and haunt them.
I always thought I had to be really fast to get it over and done with, which when I was young. And when I say young, it wasn't until my late 30s that I worked out to like go slow and pause. Pauses are good.
Mm-hmm.
But it was really going against, I don't know where I'd internalized all this idea. Probably been made to do speeches when I was at primary school, when I was absolutely not wanting to.
Yeah, and that's a good point. That's another thing that people have is that they might have had bad experiences at school where they're made to stand in front of the class.
Yeah.
And, you know, and they weren't really comfortable doing that. And so all of those memories come flooding back and and impact what they're doing in the moment when they're giving a speech.
That's, I remember those are the times when it was the strongest freak out. I remember one time I can't play piano and I'm not apparently musical, but I learned the piano for a couple of years as a kid, and my teacher, who was this old school teacher, made me go and do a performance. They had all the music teachers in the town. Every now and again, they'd have this thing in a hall where all their students would perform, you know, right, for each other.
Yeah.
And that just about wiped me out. I was so nervous. And right. I chose a short piece.
Yeah.
And luckily, I got through without making any actual mistakes. I mean, I probably didn't play with any sense of feel at all, but in terms of playing the notes in the right order,
right,
I didn't make any, and I was so relieved because I thought if I had, I probably would have just stopped.
Yeah.
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 So that's not preparation for performing in adult life, is it?
No. I think the other thing that people do is they might be doing a good job of giving the presentation, and then halfway through, they suddenly kind of relapse into, oh my God, look at all these people and they're all looking at me. Where they might get halfway through before they do that, and then that will cause them to get nervous again.
Yeah.
But it's really interesting. You know, somebody said to me once, they said, oh, you know, are you giving a presentation at a conference? It was. And they said, oh, how many people? And I said, oh, I think there's about 300. And they went, oh, 300? You must be really nervous. And I went, why? And they go, 300 people? And I went, well, it makes no difference whether there's 300 or three. You know, they're just people, people like us, you know, and they've come there because they want to presumably listen to what I've got to say. So, again, you know, that's – it's kind of almost like a social norm.
Yeah, I know, and I can hear parts of my brain wanting to argue with you as
well.
Yeah,
carry on, let that part argue, go on.
Well, it just didn't feel right, that was all. Like, it's only a small part of my brain. Because I get the logic. That's the thing, I get the logic.
Mm.
300, there's no different, they're just people.
Mm.
And I understand that it's this thing kind of been trained into me. But then deeper in the brain, it's kind of like, oh, no. Yeah. Oh, no.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that might be, you know, where the beliefs come in. So beliefs about what it is to present, you know, because we're always presenting. Even you and I, we're just having a conversation with, I don't know, how many people listening?
Couple.
But we
at least three.
But we're just having a conversation. So I'm not nervous about having a conversation, even though there's people listening. So at what point then, I'll say to people, okay, so can you talk to two people? And they go, oh, yeah, that's fine, okay. So what about, you know, six people? Oh, yeah, that's okay. Okay, what about eight people? Oh, I might be a bit nervous with eight. Okay. Well, what's the difference between six and eight?
Six and eight,
you know,
yeah.
Or between eight and ten or whatever it is. And all I'm trying to do is to reprogram the mind so that they're thinking about it, because they haven't thought about it before. They haven't thought, you know, what's making me nervous. They just think it's because I'm presenting to a crowd of people or a group of people, and it's okay to be nervous because that's what they've heard probably for their whole life.
Yeah, yeah. I remember the first time I had to go and speak to the community board when I didn't really know anyone. That was very nervous.
Yeah.
But I had a time last year, one time I spoke, and I can't remember what set me off, but I was slightly nervous. And it was like, you know, I know the community. I interview all of them.
Right, yeah.
You know, I knew most of the people in the room, some of them quite well.
Mm.
And for some reason, I went to speak and something had triggered it. Not right. Badly.
Mm.
And I don't know if anyone even noticed, but I would notice. And I was like, what the heck?
It looks like it was something that you saw.
Why do you say that?
Because you're looking, of where you're moving your eyes.
Right. I was moving my eyes to the left.
Well, you're moving right and left, actually, and up. So it's both of those are visual.
Yeah, I was trying to,
yeah.
I was visualizing the room.
With all the people in it?
I don't know. That's because I have so many memories of being in that room now.
Right.
Yeah,
is it the room itself?
No, I think it was something that had been going on in my head beforehand.
Right.
That I'd been thinking about that might have just lifted the anxiety level slightly. It might have been something not terribly related. I don't know.
Mm.
Yeah. It wasn't a biggie.
Yeah.
And if I'd been talking for long, I probably would have calmed myself back down, but it was just short.
Right. So then, you know, when people are presenting, it's like what beliefs do they have about presenting? Because if they believe that it's okay to be nervous, then, you know, they're just going to run with that. They might believe, for example, that they have to be perfect. And so, you know, that's putting stress on themselves to be perfect. And, like, what is perfect anyway? I mean, perfection really is in the eye of the beholder.
Perfect A+, 100%, 10 out of 10. Right.
Exactly. Because somebody could do a perfect presentation and be as boring as anything. People falling asleep, but they've gone through the whole thing. They've said all the information, but there might be no emotion in it. Because that's the other thing is, like, if you're presenting, I don't know, let's say you're presenting a whole lot of figures at the annual general meeting and you want people to be calm, then, you know, you don't really want to be showing emotion when you're presenting. But if you want people to be engaged in what you're saying, then you want passion and emotion. And, you know, I don't know whether perfect and perfect and lots of emotion go together. But if you're not passionate about what you're talking about, you can't expect the other people to be interested. They're going to be falling asleep. And that's the other thing that sometimes people see their audience all asleep.
If they're not reassuring. Throwing
fruit, then they're asleep.
Oh, they imagine that. Yeah. Oh, yeah, right, yeah. Well, the crowd's large enough that there's a chance that someone might fall asleep, isn't it? Exactly. They might just already be.
And then they'll focus on that one person that's asleep and not the other, you know, 90 that are all really awake and engaged and everything.
You know, something that I find hard to tell if people are engaged, I think if people are, like, actually quite engrossed and they're focused and listening, they go very quiet. Yeah. In my untrained, confused expectations about public speaking, I find that stressful because I'm like, oh, I'm not getting anything back from them.
Right.
Because it's not like a conversation where, you know, everyone talking to you and you'll keep and when you go quiet, that's when you've lost interest.
Right. Well, that's not the case, yeah.
Yeah, but of the crowd, it's certainly not the case, is it? Because you might actually have them in the palm of your hand at that
point. Exactly, yeah.
But I don't have the experience, because I don't do a lot of public speaking.
Mm.
I don't have the experience to kind of recognise that.
Well, the other thing that's important to know is that people naturally go in and out of a trance every 90 minutes.
Do we?
Yeah, so they just kind of drift away. And so you can see, you know, if you've got an audience, you can see. I mean, it's quite useful if you've got like 15 people in a training course. You can see people, you know, going into these states and coming out. It's just natural. You can't really stop it. But they're not all going to do it at the same time.
You know? Okay.
Well, there might be they do, but usually they don't. They do it at different times. Well, people, you know, what I find as well is people all yawn.
Yeah.
And they'll go, oh, I'm sorry, I'm yawning. I go, it's fine. It's just, you know, they're getting more oxygen because they're taking in new ideas and it's making them think and they yawn. So if people yawn, I always think that's a good sign because it means that they've got something new that they hadn't thought about before.
So you talk to people in group situations a lot, like groups of 15 or so.
Yeah.
So are you scanning the people just to...
Oh, I'm watching all of them.
Yeah.
Just like I'm watching you, Aaron.
Oh, don't do that. It's bad enough. I interview Marie. And I'm always aware that Marie's like reading all sorts of stuff for me. She's a counsellor. You're pretty much the same in that regard. But are you looking for... Are you using their reactions to gauge your performance? Are you going to that extent?
Well, yeah, because I'm looking to see whether they've understood.
Yeah.
So, you know, sometimes people might be looking, I don't know, how would I describe it on the radio? So they might be looking a bit quizzical, like, oh, I'm not sure I get that. And then I'll go, so can you tell me what you just understood by what I've said? Because I want to check that they've understood.
Yes.
And then they might go, oh, well, I'm not quite sure, but I think it's this. And I'll go, yeah, that's it exactly. Or almost, but there's also this bit to add into it.
Yeah.
So... what I'm doing when I'm training is I'm in what's called peripheral vision, which is when, this is like when your mom has eyes in the back of her head, you know, you're behind her and you're doing something and she goes, what are you doing? And you go, how does she know that? I'm behind her, right? So it's like, and it's a good way to drive as well. So when you're driving, you're looking at the whole landscape, not just the car in front.
Yeah.
So when I'm in a room, I'm scanning the whole room, or I'm looking at the whole room. I might be looking at you, but I can still see, like I'm looking at you now, but I can still see the door and I can still see this thing over here, this yellow thing, yeah.
Paper.
Yeah. So even though I'm looking at you, right? So I can see also if somebody says something, and somebody over the other side of the room disagrees because they'll fold their arms or turn away. And then I'll go, oh, what did you think of that? And they'll be like, oh, shit, I'll be fed out. Because sometimes people won't say, but you can pick up the body language, because the body language happens about half a second before they say anything or don't say anything. So it's kind of like, you know, when I'm training, I'm monitoring the whole room because I want to make sure everybody gets it.
Yeah, yeah.
And that they get all their questions answered and they understand and then can do the exercise, whatever it is that they're required to do, you know.
One of the things I found coaching teenagers was that by that point they're very well experienced at looking like they're listening.
Yeah.
They train themselves to look like they're listening, otherwise you get in trouble.
Right.
You know. And so you really have to watch them quite closely. And in the end, I sort of, in a way, I gave up watching them closely and thought, I'll just keep it short and sweet, because anything else is, I'm going to lose them pretty quickly.
And are these teenagers that were having to listen or?
Well, it was soccer coaching.
Soccer coaching, okay.
So theoretically, they're there voluntarily, but they've just had a day of being taught to.
Right.
And
they're all taught out.
they're taught. Well, some are focused and some are not. Yeah. You know, and so it's a bit of a variety in there. Mm. But
so with that, the best way is to get people involved in doing something.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. I always found one-on-one. If I talked to someone one-on-one, they'd always hear it.
Yeah.
But as a group, they often wouldn't hear it. They'd be tuned out.
Right. Right.
But looking like they were listening.
Yeah. So that is a good thing. Is that ask them a question. You know, what do you think about this? And then they're like, oh, shit, you might ask me next. I better pay attention.
Right, you keep them on edge.
No, not on edge, just alert.
Alert, okay, sorry. Not that far.
Yeah. So that's then in terms of the presentations, it's like what do people believe about giving a presentation to start with? Because whatever they believe is what they're going to act out. So we have beliefs first.
Yeah.
And then what happens is we behave according to the beliefs that we have. And some of the beliefs that we have, we might not believe that we have those beliefs, if that makes any sense. So they're unconscious beliefs. So somebody that believes that they have to be perfect, they might find fault with everybody else because that makes them feel more perfect.
Okay, that's the easy way to do it.
So pick flies out of everybody else because they feel more perfect then.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, like what is perfection? I say somebody could look at something and go, oh my God, that's perfect. And somebody else thinks it's not. So, you know, actually on the last course, the group that I had, they bought me a pair of socks because I kept saying to them, you know, it's okay to be imperfect. Nobody's perfect. Or either everybody's perfect or nobody's perfect. You know, they're imperfect. We're all imperfection. We're imperfect. And so they bought me this pair of socks and it's got the imperfectionist on them. Imperfectionist written down the sock.
Right. Imperfectionist.
Imperfectionist, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's again, in striving to be perfect, that's really stressful.
I keep
and
coming
who decides?
Back to, I know. I always sound like a stuck record, but I keep coming back to spending a childhood being graded and marked, and judged to whether we're good enough or not.
Exactly.
And I just feel I certainly feel like that's affected me.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the school system, and it's like to a certain extent, you know. So there's two aspects to that. One is that, we're always being graded and marked because presumably we want to get better. The other aspect to that, though, is that in life there's competition and, you know, while we can say, oh, everybody's good and, you know, everybody can achieve success, yes, we can achieve success, but success for one might be different to success for somebody else. And you know, in the real world, there are people that do certain things and there are people that can't achieve that. But they might achieve it in something else in a different way that the first person can't do. So that idea of, you know, you can never attain whatever it is that you want could be a belief as well. You know, you can never attain 100%. Like I remember once when I was a kid, I got 99% in a maths exam And my dad wanted to know why I didn't get 100%, right? It was like, okay.
Did you make him sit it? You should have made him sit it.
But it was like, oh, no, I wouldn't have done that. But it was like, I can't believe this. You know, I got, and in another exam, I got something like 26%. I think it was for writing my name right or something. I can't remember what that one was. But I didn't think I was any good at maths anyway. But to get, it must have been algebra maybe. I don't know. I've never used algebra since I left school. But I got 99% and I was so proud of myself. And he says, well, why didn't you get 100? And
I was like, I guess that's what he thought.
There's no answer to that.
That's what he thought his job was, to keep you working harder.
Yeah, keep working harder. But, it didn't have that effect though. It was like, oh.
It's like
no matter what I do, I can't please him, you know. So then you can get a belief from that, you know, like, doesn't matter what I do, it's never going to be good enough, or I'm not good enough is quite a common belief.
Yeah, and then people stop. Have. And then I notice a lot of people stop trying, because if you don't try and fail, that's better than trying and failing.
Yeah. And that's a result of that belief that I'm not good enough. And so, you know, if I say to people, do you believe you're not good enough? They'll go, no, because consciously they don't. Nobody believes that they're not good enough, but unconsciously.
Yeah.
If so they're experiencing. Well, there might be. It's basically like what would somebody experience if they believed that they weren't good enough?
So we say to them, like, to try to get to the...
Yeah. So we often imagine a third person, you know, in the room sitting over somewhere and go, okay, so this person's experiencing blah, 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 whatever it is. So what might they have to believe? And we just brainstorm some possible beliefs. And then I'll go, okay, so we've got, you know, these 10 things written down here, or 15, sometimes it's 20. And now I'm going to ask you to tell me which ones give you what feeling you get when you hear them. Because I know you don't believe this consciously. And so I'll go, you know, like, I'm not good enough. And, you know, let's mark it one out between 1 and 5, where 5 is, it's really strong because I feel it in the body when you say it.
Yeah.
And it's not an intellectual thing, you know. So go, okay, I'm not good enough. And they go, oh, yeah, that's 5, okay. It might be, what else might they believe around that? People expect too much of me. And they go, oh, no, that's only 1. And so we go through all these beliefs that we've dreamed up to see which are the strongest ones. And then I'll do some kind of process with them to clear that belief, where it's come from, because it could have come from, like, usually before the age of 7.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's been passed down. Like, there's a lot of beliefs people have about money. You know, like, money doesn't grow on trees, you know, you can never have enough, you know, you have to watch every penny. That's a whole lot of, you know, things that people say that they've heard their parents say, and they hear it over and over and over and
that's such a big topic. It's like asking a fish about water, it doesn't know what water is, and it's surrounded by it. Like, exactly. Our beliefs about money are something that we're not very aware of, but we live in it because we deal with money every day.
Yeah,
there's a whole interview series, that one.
Yeah, and there was a podcast we did a while ago, you and I, about beliefs and about the unconscious mind. So your unconscious mind is kind of running the show for the most part. You know, we're doing today what we did yesterday for 95% of the time. Yeah. And then, you know, might have 5% new thought if we're lucky. But I forgot where I was going with that now.
Beliefs.
Where was I going?
Habitual beliefs, it sounds like. or unconscious. Oh, no, unconscious programming, more like.
Yeah, so the unconscious programming then, now I've lost it, I forgot where I was going with it.
Okay. Does that mean it's time to wrap up?
No, it's up to you. What were we talking about before that second?
Well, see, I think we've got, it's funny because we talked at the start of the interview about how we have a tight topic, and then by the end of it, we're just having a conversation that's going everywhere, and I think we've reached that point. Which, did we talk ourselves into that?
Well, we might have done
that. We basically planned how it was going to go unwittingly.
Yeah.
But
just to wrap up then, I think the main thing is that we're often not aware of these beliefs.
Yeah.
But we can determine what those beliefs are by our behaviour.
Explain.
So like I said, so if I've got somebody with me, so what might somebody have to believe to be experiencing, for example, to be experiencing having repeated unsuccessful relationships.
Okay.
So let's say I've got somebody that's come and they go, look, you know, I've had four relationships in the last 2 years and I don't know what's wrong. Okay. So, okay, let's explore that. So if you, if what might somebody else, so somebody over here in this other chair, what might they have to believe, given that the beliefs come first and then we attract that to us because we behave in certain ways?
Yeah.
And so we go, okay, so because I've done this quite a lot of times, I go, okay, so it might be I don't deserve to be loved. I'm not lovable.
Yeah.
All the men I like leave. If it's a woman, you know, it usually is. Well, not that it usually is, but usually, it's usually women that come and see me about it.
Yes, right,
men.
Yep.
All the men I love leave. So that might have resulted because their father left when they were a child, when they were really little. And so then they've got a belief that if you love somebody, they're going to leave. So then they exhibit behaviour of not loving the person because they think they're going to leave, and then, of course, they leave. So it gets quite complicated. But once they change the belief, then it changes everything because they stop doing those behaviours that are driving the person away.
It's just a matter of getting outside it and seeing it for what it is.
Yeah. And as I say, those beliefs, they're not usually conscious, because if they were, they could fix them. They're usually unconscious, come from programming from, you know, say often before the age of seven. And so then once we find out which ones gets the biggest sensory feelings related to it, then that's the one that we work with. And sometimes we have to fiddle around with it to get it exactly right. But there's some kind of universal ones like I'm not good enough or I don't deserve or those kind of things that there might be slight variations on that. And then, you know, change the belief and then the whole life changes because we filter everything through those beliefs.
Yeah.
And we act according to those. So you look at what people actually do and that gives you an idea of what they might be believing that's causing them to behave that way.
Well, folks, we've been talking to Stephanie Philp, a Inside Your Mind segment with Stephanie. And that's actually the name of your business. I stole it from her business name, but it seemed like a good one.
Yeah. It's insideyourmind.com.
Yeah, yeah. And you've probably got articles about beliefs. I'm sure you've got articles about beliefs on there.
Yeah, I have. Yeah,
yeah. Because we talk about that in the end. We talk about that quite a lot.
Yeah.
Beliefs.
That's so powerful.
Yeah.
Positively and negatively.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for coming in.